will proceed to the fifth case, Dye versus Frank. Mr. Bailey.
May it please the court. I represent Stephen Dye, and my position is that my client's right against double jeopardy was violated when he was prosecuted for possession of drugs with intent to deliver, following the jeopardy tax collection on those same drugs, pursuant to the pre-1997 Wisconsin Controlled Substance Tax, because the statute was criminal and not civil in nature and targeted dealers. The second prosecution, for which he was later went to jury trial and convicted of, should be vacated by this court because it violated constitutional rights against double jeopardy. State v. Hall established that the Wisconsin Controlled Substance Tax was a criminal statute and struck it down. It only applied to illegal activities, the selling of drugs. It was triggered by an arrest, and the gentleman was taxed, my client was taxed for property that was no longer even in his possession. Quite a bit of briefing has been around the Halper, Kurth Ranch, and then the Hudson decision. Halper, I would like to point out to the court, should be very narrowly construed because I think it really addresses, and I quote from Stevens' decision on Ranch and Hudson, is a rule for the rare case because, of course, in that matter, in Halper, a person was convicted of defrauding Medicare 65 times for $9 at a time for a total of about $600. But the punitive aspect of that case was that he was looking at $130,000 in punitive assessments, which the court said, well, this is a pretty rare case. The problem was, of course, the court later said, we emphasize that one aspect that under the Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez was just one useful guidepost. But looking at Kurth Ranch, even though they look at Halper, they look at the other guidepost, which, of course, is the statute is only applied after the taxpayer is arrested. It's levied on goods no longer in possession, and it's conditioned on the commission of a crime. Just as the jeopardy tax collection here, if you look in the appendix, of course, it says what is this gentleman's arrest date, and then we, because he's going to hold the drugs for resale, we're going to tax him for doing that. And what's so problematic about that is, of course, that when the legislature drafted this statute, they knew full well they could draft it in a certain way that it wouldn't be struck down. Minnesota has similar law. They even attached it to the legislative history saying, well, this is the way we should draft this, but they ignored it. So the intention then of the legislature was both punitive and deterrent to locate drug dealers and to prosecute them, making it criminal. And of course, as soon as the assessment went into place, that is when I am arguing that jeopardy attached. And because of this, he could not be prosecuted again, because in this case, what really differentiates it from other cases, such as, say, the Fifth Circuit decision, United States versus Sanchez-Escarano, is that they actually collected the money and satisfied the tax assessment.
Just let me make one thing clear for myself, please. If we analyze the law under Hudson, you're saying that we come to the same conclusion as your analysis under Kurth?
Right. Well, the interesting point to be made there, of course, is that in Hudson, we go back to the original guidepost that was set forth by the Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez matter. I think a careful reading of Kurth Ranch, I don't think they put as much weight on Halper as has been briefed and argued, because I think when you look at Kurth Ranch, it says we look at that as one factor, but of course that isn't why they came to the decision they did in Kurth Ranch. They looked at other factors. And whenever we look at these tax stamp laws around the country, it's important to look at all the guideposts and give them weight. And I think what's problematic for all the courts in making these decisions, each statute's unique, each one has different weightings you give it. And what's interesting is that this circuit and Warnke looked at the fact that eventually this case that's before the court right now was eventually going to occur, where a tax has been levied prior to the drug prosecution, and then, if I recall, the decision says the Supreme Court would then have to determine whether the taxing procedure resulted in the attachment of jeopardy. And for each and every statute we look at, we have to look at all the guideposts to make the determination of whether or not it is a jeopardy collection, whether or not he's been put in jeopardy. And that's what I'm presenting to the court, that given the unique set of facts where the money was actually taken, jeopardy attached, jeopardy was satisfied, and once that bridge is crossed, just like in a criminal prosecution where the jury is sworn, or where the first, in a court trial where the first witness is sworn, that's it. And you can't go back. And I know the court might be looking at this case and maybe in thinking, do we vacate a criminal conviction because of simple assessment of a tax? I don't think that has anything to do with the quality of it. It's a constitutional issue. And that is the bedrock, as Stevens puts it, of American jurisprudence, is that double jeopardy is double jeopardy, and we do not compromise that constitutional factor. Because to do so, we start going down a slippery slope. There are so many administrative forfeiture proceedings that have been found criminal, found not to be criminal. When we look at, say, Hudson, that case, the initiation of administrative disbarment from banking as well as some civil forfeitures didn't necessarily need these people to be charged with a crime. Tax stamp does. They have to be arrested and they have to be prosecuted, or else the tax stamp isn't generated in that matter. And looking at all these cases, it really needs to be established by the court on this case, given that the tax stamp law, when this case occurred, was as it is, and then later the Supreme Court in Wisconsin determined it is a bad law. I think that points very clearly to the fact that we have a criminal sanction. Money was assessed against my client and taken out of account. And I know some of the cases I cite are quite old. And they're still good law, though. Because you got to remember, the double jeopardy clause is pretty darn old, too. But we still think it's a pretty good idea. And we subscribe to it. And it's constitutional. And I know maybe I'm beating a dead horse on that point. But once your jeopardy attaches and is satisfied, the finality that we look for in America under the double jeopardy clause has to be held very high. Because to be continuously looking over your shoulder thinking, gosh, is the government going to come after me again and again for the same set of circumstances, the same facts, makes life less, the quality of life far less than it should be. In America, we should be guaranteed the right to finality. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bailey. Mr. Weber.
Members of the court, good morning. My name is Greg Weber. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin. I represent the respondent, Matthew Frank, in this proceeding. I want to begin by addressing a point made by counsel for Mr. Dye, who's asked this court to recognize that State versus Hall, Wisconsin Supreme Court's case, stands for the proposition that the Wisconsin Controlled Substances Tax Law is a criminal statute. Hall doesn't stand for that at all. The Wisconsin Supreme Court held in Hall that the first version of the Wisconsin Controlled Substances Tax Law, try saying that fast, violated a taxpayer's right to be free from compelled self-incrimination. It was a Fifth Amendment compelled self-incrimination case. The constitutional infirmity, according to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, was related to the manner in which a taxpayer had to comply with the statute, the actual purchasing of the stamps, the affixing and display requirement of the stamps, and the manner in which the stamps were purchased. All of these combined to work a Fifth Amendment compelled self-incrimination violation. It has nothing to do with whether the statute is criminal in nature or not.
But why shouldn't the state be held to the finding of the Wisconsin Supreme Court that the statute is punitive and criminal and not civil?
Well, for one thing, the Wisconsin Supreme Court in Hall was not called upon in Hall to answer that question. The comments that were made by the author of the majority opinion in that case were part of the analysis, but it wasn't a Kurth Ranch type of analysis. There wasn't a double jeopardy claim being presented in that case. And while counsel for Mr. Dye talks about beating a dead horse in terms of the double jeopardy analysis, one horse has gone out of the stable and hasn't been addressed by Mr. Dye or his counsel. And that's the question of the mootness finding.
Your jurisdictional argument is a non-starter. What if the Wisconsin court was wrong about the issue being moot? Is that decision unreviewable?
If the Wisconsin Supreme Court was wrong on the question of mootness, if that were to be considered by this court to be a substantive decision under the AEDPA, they would have a limited right to be wrong. We've treated it as a procedural argument that has to be addressed by the federal court in the exercise of their Article III jurisdiction.
Look, a state court finding of mootness cannot deprive this court of habeas jurisdiction.
It can if the finding of mootness is an independent and adequate state ground upon which to resolve the federal claim. Or not. We'll advance the mootness argument on brief. The state's position in this litigation is that the district court should not have considered the claim on its merits, and that this court ought not consider the claim on its merits. That the Court of Appeals' mootness finding is an independent and adequate state ground upon which to uphold the state court's decision.
Mr. Weber, can Wisconsin prosecute a man twice with two different juries and two different judges and then cancel the case that results in a lower penalty?
In one instance, in a prosecution, a simultaneous prosecution for driving under the influence of alcohol and driving with a prohibited BAC content, two questions can be put to the jury. One, actually the state elects to go forward on one at the close of the trial. But yes, absolutely under that context it can. I find myself unwilling to take the court's time to summarize arguments on the Hudson issue that are set forth in our brief. We've made our position clear. If the court has no more questions.
Oh, I do. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
But I do. Because I'm wondering if the state of Wisconsin can now impose an additional monetary fine on Mr. Dye.
For violating the tax stamp
mm-hmm.
provision? No, we're barred. We're barred from that. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals held that and actually considered Mr. Dye's original appellate argument, in which Dye's counsel argued that the state could come back at some point in the future and try and reassert the tax penalty. The Court of Appeals held that under law of the case doctrine, we'd be barred.
And tell me, how do you respond to Park, the Fifth Circuit case? Because, you know, I fear you're suggesting that we create a circuit split.
As to which particular issue before the court?
Well,
as to the Hudson issue
yeah.
or as to the mootness issue? Our analysis, first of all, I'd be inclined to believe that the Wisconsin controlled substances tax law is probably not the same tax law in point in part. Secondly, this court can perform an independent Hudson analysis. We'll probably give greater or lesser weight to the factors that are identified in Hudson than the Fifth Circuit did in its case. The determination actually is dependent on the quality of Mr. Dye's argument on those factors. It's Dye's burden, not the state, to make a showing under the clearest proof standard that the Wisconsin statute is punitive, and we contend that it is not, or criminal, we contend it is not. I thank the court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Weber. Mr. Bailey?
Thank you. Looking at the Hall decision, I think it's important. I understand why it was struck down, but also the court analyzed its statute looking at the various guideposts under the Kennedy decision that one should look at. It really didn't have a revenue generating function, hence the money. It wasn't there to really collect a tax. Just because you brand something as civil doesn't make it so. Its effective operation, of course, as pointed out in the Hall decision, it's not just what they did, but what they found and what they discussed and what the statute actually tended to do. It didn't give anyone the anonymity to just go out and get a tax stamp. However, the tax stamp only applied when one was arrested and one was prosecuted. The mootness issue, with all due respect, the Court of Appeals, if one looks back in the history of this case, clearly saw that Basically what happened was there was assessment established for 3 years, even after the money was returned, the Department of Revenue continued that assessment. However, they all of a sudden, before it went up on appeal, decided to withdraw that. I think all of that is totally irrelevant to this court's analysis under the constitutional double jeopardy clause. I think that this court has full jurisdiction to look at the substantive prosecution and to strike it down and to dismiss that entire case for the simple reason that it violated my client's constitutional right against double jeopardy, and I think, and I'd ask this court to do that because it's a violation of constitutional rights for that conviction to stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Thank you, Mr. Weber. The case is taken under